Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Mayday. Chapter 8. When Edith came out into the clear blue of the May night, she found the avenue deserted. The windows of the big shops were dark. Over their doors were drawn great iron masks, until they were only shadowy tombs of the late day's splendor. Glancing down toward 42nd Street, she saw a commingled blur of lights from the all-night restaurants. Over on 6th Avenue, the elevated, a flare of fire, roared across the street between the glimmering parallels of light at the station and streaked along into the crisp dark. But at 44th Street it was very quiet. Pulling her cloak close about her, Edith darted across the avenue. She started nervously as a solitary man passed her and said in a hoarse whisper, "Where are you bound, kiddo?" She was reminded of a night in her childhood when she had walked around the block in her pajamas and a dog had howled at her from a mystery big black yard. In a minute, she had reached her destination, a two-story, comparatively old building on 44th, in the upper window of which she thankfully detected a wisp of light. It was bright enough outside for her to make out the sign beside the window, the New York Trumpet. She stepped inside a dark hall and, after a second, saw the stairs in the corner. Then she was in a long, low room furnished with many desks and hung on all sides with filed copies of newspapers. There were only two occupants. They were sitting at different ends of the room, each wearing a green eyeshade, and writing by a solitary desk light. For a moment, she stood uncertainly in the doorway, and then both men turned around simultaneously, and she recognized her brother. "Why, Edith!" He rose quickly and approached her in surprise, removing his eyeshade. He was a tall, lean, and dark man with black, piercing eyes under very thick glasses. They were far-away eyes that seemed always fixed just over the head of the person to whom he was talking. He put his hands on her arms and kissed her cheek. "What is it?" he repeated in some alarm. "I was at a dance across at Delmonico's, Henry," she said excitedly, "and I couldn't resist tearing over to see you." "Well, I'm glad you did." His alertness gave way quickly to a habitual vagueness. "You oughtn't to be out alone at night, though, ought you?" The man at the other end of the room had been looking at them curiously, but at Henry's beckoning gesture he approached. He was loosely fat, with little twinkling eyes, and, having removed his collar and tie, he gave the impression of a Middle Western farmer on a Sunday afternoon. "This is my sister," said Henry. "She dropped in to see me."
"How do you do?" said the fat man, smiling. "My name's Bartholomew, Miss Braden. I know your brother has forgotten it long ago."
Edith laughed politely.
"Well," he continued, "not exactly gorgeous quarters we have here, are they?"
Edith looked around the room. "They seem very nice," she replied. "Where do you keep the bombs?"
"The bombs?" repeated Bartholomew, laughing. "Oh, that's pretty good, the bombs. Oh, did you hear her, Henry? She wants to know where we keep the bombs. Say, that's pretty good."
Edith swung herself onto a vacant desk and sat dangling her feet over the edge. Her brother took a seat beside her.
"Well," he asked absent-mindedly, "how do you like New York this trip?"
"Not bad. I'll be over at the Biltmore with the Hoyts until Sunday. Can't you come to luncheon tomorrow?" He thought a moment.
"Oh, I'm especially busy," he objected, "and I hate women in groups."
"All right," she agreed, unruffled. "Let you and me have luncheon together."
"Very well. I'll call for you at 12.
Bartholomew was obviously anxious to return to his desk, but apparently considered that it would be rude to leave without some parting pleasantry.
"Well," he began awkwardly.
They both turned to him.
"Well, we had an exciting time earlier in the evening."
The two men exchanged glances.
"You should have come earlier," continued Bartholomew, somewhat encouraged. "We had a regular vaudeville."
"Did you really?"
"A serenade," said Henry. "A lot of soldiers gathered down there in the street and began to yell at the sign."
"Why?" she demanded.
"Just a crowd," said Henry abstractedly. "All crowds have to howl. They didn't have anybody with much initiative in the lead, or they'd probably have forced their way in here and smashed things up."
"Yes,"
said Bartholomew, turning again to Edith.
"You should have been here."
He seemed to consider this a sufficient cue for withdrawal, for he turned abruptly and went back to his desk. "Are the soldiers all set against the socialists?" demanded Edith of her brother. "I mean, do they attack you violently and all that?" Henry replaced his eye shade and yawned. "The human race has come a long way," he said casually, "but most of us are throwbacks. The soldiers don't know what they want or what they hate or what they like. They're used to acting in large bodies, and they seem to have to make demonstrations. So it happens to be against us. There have been riots all over the city tonight. It's May Day, you see."
"Was the disturbance here pretty serious?"
"Oh, not a bit," he said scornfully. "About 25 of them stopped in the street about 9 o'clock and began to bellow at the moon."
"Oh."
She changed the subject.
"You're glad to see me, Henry."
"Why, sure."
"You don't seem to be."
"I am."
"I suppose you think I'm a waster, short of the world's worst butterfly."
Henry laughed.
"Not at all. Have a good time while you're young. Why, do I seem like the priggish and earnest youth?"
"No," she paused. "But somehow I began thinking how absolutely different the party I'm on is from all your purposes. It seems sort of incongruous, doesn't it? Me being at a party like that, and you over here working for a thing that'll make that sort of party impossible ever any more, if your ideas work."
"I don't think of it that way. You're young, and you're acting just as you were brought up to act. Go ahead. Have a good time."
Her feet, which had been idly swinging, stopped, and her voice dropped a note.
I wish you'd come back to Harrisburg and have a good time. Do you feel sure that you're on the right track?"
"You're wearing beautiful stockings," he interrupted. "What on earth are they?"
"Oh, they're embroidered," she replied, glancing down. "Aren't they cunning?"
She raised her skirts and uncovered slim, silk-sheathed calves. "Or do you disapprove of silk stockings?" He seemed slightly exasperated, bent his dark eyes on her piercingly.
"Are you trying to make me out as criticizing you in any way, Edith?"
"Not at all."
She paused. Bartholomew had uttered a grunt. She turned and saw that he had left his desk and was standing at the window.
"What is it?" demanded Henry.
"People," said Bartholomew. And then after an instant, "Whole jam of them. They're coming from Sixth Avenue."
"People?"
The fat man pressed his nose to the pane.
"Soldiers, by God," he said emphatically. "I had an idea they'd come back."
Edith jumped to her feet, and running over, joined Bartholomew at the window.
"There's a lot of them," she cried excitedly. "Come here, Henry."
Henry readjusted his shade, but kept his seat.
Hadn't we better turn out the lights?" suggested Bartholomew.
"No, they'll go away in a minute."
"They're not," said Edith, peering from the window. "They're not even thinking of going away. There's more of them coming. Look, there's a whole crowd turning the corner of Sixth Avenue."
By the yellow glow and blue shadows of the street lamp, she could see that the sidewalk was crowded with men. They were mostly in uniform, some sober, some enthusiastically drunk, and over the whole swept an incoherent clamor and shouting. Henry rose, and going to the window, exposed himself as a long silhouette against the office lights. Immediately the shouting became a steady yell, and a rattling fusillade of small missiles, corners of tobacco plugs, cigarette boxes, and even pennies beat against the window. The sounds of the racket now began floating up the stairs as the folding doors revolved.
"They're coming up!" cried Bartholomew.
Edith turned anxiously to Henry.
"They're coming up, Henry."
From downstairs in the lower hall, their cries were now quite audible.
"Goddamned socialist! Pro-Germans! Bosch lovers! Second floor front, come on! We don't get the sons of..."
The next 5 minutes passed in a dream. Edith was conscious that the clamor burst suddenly upon the three of them like a cloud of rain, that there was a thunder of many feet on the stairs, that Henry had seized her arm and drawn her back toward the rear of the office. Then the door opened, and an overflow of men were forced into the room. Not the leaders, but simply those who happened to be in front.
"Hello, Bo. Up late, ain't you? You and your girl, damn you."
She noticed that two very drunken soldiers had been forced to the front, where they wobbled fatuously. One of them was short and dark. The other was tall and weak of chin. Henry stepped forward and raised his hand.
"Friends," he said.
The clamor faded into a momentary stillness, punctuated with mutterings. "Friends," he repeated, his faraway eyes fixed over the heads of the crowd. "You're injuring no one but yourselves by breaking in here tonight. Do we look like rich men? Do we look like Germans? I ask you in all fairness."
"Pipe down! I'll say you do. Say, who's your lady friend, buddy?"
A man in civilian clothes who had been pawing over a table suddenly held up a newspaper.
"Here it is," he shouted. "They wanted the Germans to win the war."
A new overflow from the stairs was shouldered in, and of a sudden the room was full of men, all closing around the pale little group at the back. Edith saw that the tall soldier with the weak chin was still in front. The short dark one had disappeared. She edged slightly backward, stood close to the open window, through which came a clear breath of cool night air. Then the room was a riot. She realized that the soldiers were surging forward, glimpsed the fat man swinging a chair over his head. Instantly the lights went out, and she felt the push of warm bodies under rough cloth, and her ears were full of shouting and trampling and hard breathing. A figure flashed by her out of nowhere, tottered, was edged sideways, and of a sudden disappeared helplessly out through the open window with a frightened, fragmentary cry that died staccato on the bosom of the clamor. By the faint light streaming from the building backing on the area, Edith had a quick impression that it had been the tall soldier with the weak chin. Anger rose astonishingly in her. She swung her arms wildly, edged blindly toward the thickest of the scuffling. She heard grunts, curses, the muffled impact of fists. "Henry!" she called frantically. "Henry!" Then, it was minutes later, she felt suddenly that there were other figures in the room. She heard a voice, deep, bullying, authoritative. She saw yellow rays of light sweeping here and there in the fracas. The cries became more scattered, the scuffling increased, and then stopped. Suddenly the lights were on, and the room was full of policemen, clubbing left and right. The deep voice boomed out, "Here now! Here now! Here now!" And then, "Quiet down and get out! Here now!" The room seemed to empty like a washbowl. A policeman, fast grappled in the corner, released his hold on his soldier antagonist and started him with a shove toward the door. The deep voice continued. Edith perceived now that it came from a bull-necked police captain standing near the door.
"Here now, this is no way. One of your own soldiers got shoved out of the back window and killed himself."
"Henry," called Edith. "Henry." She beat wildly with her fists on the back of the man in front of her. She brushed between two others, fought, shrieked, and beat her way to a very pale figure sitting on the floor close to a desk.
"Henry," she cried passionately, "what's the matter? What's the matter? Did they hurt you?"
His eyes were shut. He groaned, and then, looking up, said disgustedly, "They broke my leg. My God, the fools!"
"Here now," called the police captain. "Here now! Here now!"
The end of Chapter 8 of May Day, as originally published in Tales from the Jazz Age by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Read by Rick Kistner for Litigo on the web at fcit.usf.edu.